November 21, 2013. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. The United States Supreme Court earlier this week decided that the state of Texas can go ahead with its restrictions on abortion. Those restrictions were first nullified as unconstitutional by U.S. District Court, and then a three-judge panel of the U.S. District Court of Appeals in New Orleans decided that the state of Texas could go ahead with the restrictions, given the fact that in the view of the panel, the state was likely to prevail in eventual arguments. As Adam Liptak of the New York Times reported on Wednesday, the Supreme Court turned away an emergency application asking it to block a Texas law that requires doctors performing abortions to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. The decision was a 5-4 decision, and as many in the media have noted, it was a predictable breakdown between the nine justices. The effect of the ruling, said Justice Stephen Breyer, was that there will be at least 24 counties in the Rio Grande Valley area of Texas without abortion clinics. As Justice Breyer said, quote, it may substantially reduce access to safe abortions elsewhere in Texas, end quote. On the other hand, writing for the 5-4 majority, Justice Antonin Scalia said that the challengers to the law had not met the very high level of burden that was required to ask the Supreme Court to alter the appeals court provisional decision. Justice Scalia said, quote, reasonable minds can perhaps disagree about whether the Court of Appeals should have granted a stay in this case. But the justice continued, there is no doubt that the applicants have not carried their heavy burden of showing that doing so was a clear violation of accepted legal standards, which do not include a special status quo standard for laws affecting abortion, end quote. Looking closer at these two statements by these two justices, a very important issue arises. Justice Scalia says that what the applicants in this particular court action were asking for is that access to abortion without the restrictions under the new Texas law should be the status quo, at least until the appeals court rules in the case. That's a very interesting argument. It's an argument, nonetheless, that seems to make a great deal of sense to pro-abortion and pro-choice forces in this country. We don't have to be able to read their minds to read their logic. The logic is that abortion, access to abortion without such restrictions, should be considered such a settled legal fact that even when such a law is now under appeal, the status quo should prevail until and unless some court rules otherwise. Of course, under this understanding, the status quo would mean unfettered access to abortion, or at least access to abortion without the specific restrictions passed under the new Texas law. The clash between Justices Breyer and Scalia on this decision underlines a deeper clash, a clash of jurisprudence, the understanding of the role and purpose of the U.S. Constitution, and the role and purpose of the court itself. Later in his opinion, Justice Breyer actually goes back to the status quo argument. He wrote this, quote, I would maintain the status quo of allowing clinics in Texas to provide the abortions. He said, quote, while the lower courts consider this difficult, sensitive, and controversial legal matter, end quote. Well, of course, as other justices pointed out, almost every case that eventually arises to the U.S. Supreme Court could be described as difficult, sensitive, and controversial. Justice Breyer went on to write, the longer a given facility remains closed, the less likely it is ever to reopen, even if the admitting privileges requirement is ultimately held unconstitutional. End quote. Seen in this light, this is a very defensive argument, and it may well be that the pro-abortion and pro-choice forces in this case understand themselves to be truly on the defensive. After all, they did win at the district court level, only to be reversed, at least in terms of immediate action, by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans, and then, of course, they found themselves turned down by a majority of justices at the U.S. Supreme Court for an immediate rescue from the decision of the Court of Appeals. In his status quo worldview, Justice Breyer was joined by Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg, Sonia Sotomayor, and Elena Kagan. In his decision for the court, Justice Scalia was joined by Justices Samuel A. Alito, Jr. and Clarence Thomas. Also joining in the decision, but not in the opinion, were the Chief Justice of the United States, John Roberts, joined by Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy. As the Associated Press reported yesterday, the case remains on appeal to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. That court is expected to hear arguments in January, and the law will remain in effect at least until then. This decision is certainly good news for the unborn in the state of Texas, but it is good news that could have an expiration point. We're going to have to watch very closely as this case develops at the Fifth Circuit. One of the most important things for us to recognize at this point is that there is a basic worldview clash that is clearly on display here. This is not merely a clash over jurisprudence and constitutional interpretation. It's not even merely a clash over the issue of abortion and the meaning of human life. It is indeed a clash over the most basic issues related to human dignity, the sanctity of human life, and the entire worldview in which abortion either makes sense or fails to make sense, is seen to be a woman's right, or is seen to be the murder of an unborn child. Those two worldviews, and they are certainly complicated in terms of how these things are worked out, are nonetheless simple in terms of the contrast between them. This is a clash of worldviews, a clash of values, a clash of moralities. And, once again, this clash finds its focus at the U.S. Supreme Court. Even though this case will go back to the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans, eventually virtually everyone understands that it will arrive once again for a decision of the U.S. Supreme Court. And that sets up our analysis of another issue in the news today, and that is the announcement by Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid of Nevada that the Senate is likely to move forward with modifications to the filibuster rule that would allow President Obama's nominations to several federal court positions to go forward in spite of Republican opposition. The rules of the Senate have been in place for a very long time, and the Senate is a very change-averse institution. At least it usually is, and at least until now on this issue it has been. But Democrats have been warning for some time that they move toward what both parties call the nuclear option in the Senate, and that is a revision of the filibuster rules. Both parties have used the filibuster in order to prevent presidents from making nominations to the court. When the president was a Republican, Democrats in the Senate used the filibuster. Now that a Democrat is in the White House, Republicans are using and have used the filibuster rule. It takes 60 votes to force an issue on the floor of the Senate. The Democrats have 55 members of the Senate. In order to get to 60, at least 5 Republicans must vote for cloture in order to bring the vote to the floor. When the minority party in the Senate is unified, as the Republicans are now, that cloture vote is impossible to reach. That's why Senator Reid, joined by other Democratic senators, now says it might be time to change the rule and eliminate the filibuster for presidential nominations. This is, however, a very radical move. The use of the nomenclature of the so-called nuclear option is entirely appropriate, and even some Democrats clearly have cold feet. After all, the situation can be so easily reversed. Once a Republican's in the White House, Democrats, if in the minority in the Senate, would be unable to stop a president's nominee. In the case of the two Democratic senators from the state of California, Barbara Boxer and Dianne Feinstein, both of these ardently pro-abortion senators have held to the filibuster rule because they fear the day when a Republican president might appoint a pro-life justice or judge they want to block. And yet, both of those Democratic senators have given indication to the media that they may well now support the nuclear option. Jeremy Peters of the New York Times explains why the Democrats may have come to this conclusion, and particularly why they have come to this conclusion at this specific time. He writes, quote, "The stakes seem higher this time for many Democrats. Many of them strongly believe that if Mr. Obama is not able to appoint any judges to the court, Republicans have rejected 4 of the 5 nominees he has submitted, it will retain its conservative bent for decades. It is a crucially important court for any White House because it often decides cases that relate to administration or federal agency policies," end quote. The reference to the specific court here, in which the justices are named, is the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, and that is the court that often also provides nominees for the U.S. Supreme Court. We must all be reminded that elections have consequences, and one of the consequences of the election of a president of the United States is that the sole authority for nominating judges, federal judges that is in the presidency, and thus President Obama is currently the only person on the planet who can nominate those who will sit in federal judgeships. Now, well into his second term in office, President Obama is meeting some real success in reshaping the federal judiciary. President Obama basically boasted about this recently, in fact earlier this month, when he spoke to a private Democratic senatorial campaign committee fundraiser. He said this, quote, "We are remaking the courts," end quote. Well, he is. and the only thing that is stopping him from remaking the courts even to a further degree is the filibuster rule and the unity of Republicans in the United States Senate to prevent the confirmation of some of President Obama's nominees. When it comes to the court in the District of Columbia that is its central issue here, President Obama is actually trying to expand the number of judges active on the court from 8 to 11. Many Republicans call this court packing, referring back to a similar effort made by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt during his administration. Let's face the facts. This much is very clear. Judges matter. Both sides in this controversy know it. President Obama knows it, and the Democratic senators in the Senate know it, and so do the Republican senators, and so do American citizens watching the story unfold. Finally, on this issue, sources very close to Majority Leader Harry Reid have indicated that if this action happens, it is likely to happen before the end of this week. So we'll all be watching very closely. One of the biggest issues on our cultural horizon is the legalization of same-sex marriage. Cheryl Wittstein, writing for the Washington Times yesterday, points out that gay marriage momentum, and that momentum is huge, it is represented this week by the fact that the governor of Illinois has signed into law the legislation legalizing same-sex marriage in that state. But Wittstein writes that that momentum may now be hitting some bumps in the road. Using language familiar both to the opponents and the advocates of legal same-sex marriage, the days of easy targets when it comes to states may now be over, at least for a while. As Wittstein writes, as Illinois becomes the 16th state to approve gay marriage at a public signing ceremony this week, the political trench warfare over same-sex unions may be facing a watershed moment. Illinois is the last state where gay marriage advocates have an advantage in both the governor's office and the state house, and defenders of traditional marriage say the political playing field will be much more level in the remaining 34 states. We are indebted to Wittstein for some fairly sophisticated analysis of the state-by-state breakdown. She writes, the state-by-state battle over gay marriage was set up by the Supreme Court's 5-4 decision in June striking down the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. Although gay marriage supporters hailed the ruling as a victory, the High Court declined to take the more ambitious step of invalidating all laws at the state level banning gay marriage. With many states unlikely to approve gay marriage by law or popular referendum for the foreseeable future, the Supreme Court's decision meant the battle shifted to each of the 50 states and the District of Columbia to set their own policies. In addition to the state of Oregon, 27 states have constitutional amendments defining marriage only as the union of one man and one woman. She mentions Oregon singled out here because it is where many advocates of same-sex marriage are now directing their attention. So that means 28 states have constitutional amendments defining marriage as the union of a man and a woman and only the union of a man and a woman. That is a majority of the states. Gay couples, she writes, have mounted legal challenges to these measures in states including Arkansas, Colorado, Idaho, Kentucky, Louisiana, Michigan, Nevada, North Carolina, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Utah, and Virginia. Three states that do not have constitutional provisions on gay marriage, those three states are West Virginia, New Mexico, and Pennsylvania, already are embroiled in freedom to marry lawsuits, most of them at the federal level. That leaves, she writes, Wyoming as the only state in the union that doesn't permit same-sex marriage, doesn't outlaw it by a voter-passed constitutional amendment, and isn't embroiled in a lawsuit over the issue. That's one state. That one state is Wyoming, and that one state stands out in this singular way for now. That could all be over tomorrow if a lawsuit is filed in that state. There is no question that the long-term momentum is on the side of those who are pushing for the legalization of same-sex marriage. That is pointed out in the fact that even though only 16 states and the District of Columbia currently have same-sex marriage on the books, according to most estimates, that amounts to about 38% of the United States population. That's almost 4 out of every 10 Americans. Once again, this points to the fact that geography matters, culture matters, and culture is tied to geography. When it comes to the states, they are radically different in many ways. They're different on the issue of abortion, with some states, such as the states of California and New York, being avidly pro-abortion, while other states, especially in the heartland and the South, are avidly pro-life. Those same states, by and large, but not exactly, also overlay on the issue of same-sex marriage. The kind of cultural and moral conservatism that marks certain states finds its mirror opposite in states in the same union. the fact that on many issues you can color the states respectively by worldview, including on political issues. For instance, the states divided between blue states that lean Democratic and red states that lean Republican. This tells us that geography still matters. Where you live, the community in which you reside, still makes a difference in terms of worldview, political positions, moral understandings, and much else as well. Yesterday at the White House, President Barack Obama awarded the Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor given to American citizens, to several people, the most famous of whom is former President Bill Clinton. President Clinton was awarded the Medal of Freedom by President Obama in a very clear statement by the current president that he not only depends upon and continues to admire the former president, but has needed his political support at crucial turns. As many in the media pointed out, President Obama has a very awkward relationship with President Clinton, and yet, using the language of the therapeutic employed by some observers, they seem to have an almost codependent relationship. There is another anomaly at work here. As the Washington Times also observed, quote, although Mr. Clinton is one of only two presidents in history to be impeached, he is more popular in polls than President Obama. A Gallup poll released earlier this month had 55% of Americans judging that Mr. Clinton had done an outstanding or above average job in his two terms in office. He ranked third in this poll behind modern presidents John F. Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. That same survey, says the Times, had Mr. Obama getting such ratings from only 28% of respondents. Many polls are showing that President Obama's popularity and favorability ratings have been falling precipitously. But President Clinton was not the only American honored with the Medal of Freedom. Joining him were other honorees, including Oprah Winfrey, Loretta Lynn, Washington Post former editor Ben Bradley, former Chicago Cubs baseball player Ernie Banks, retired United States Senator Richard Lugar of Indiana, feminist icon Gloria Steinem, former University of North Carolina basketball coach Dean Smith, and, posthumously, astronaut Sally Ride. Two persons specifically on this list have been getting a lot of attention, even in the liberal media. The first of them is Gloria Steinem. Of course, she is a very famous and outspoken feminist. She spoke very clearly to the media just before she received the Medal of Honor in terms of the issue of abortion. She said simply, it shouldn't be an issue. Approximately one in three women in this country needs an abortion at some time in her life, she said. It should be a part of reproductive rights. We want to diminish the number. Nobody wants to get up in the morning and think, quote, I want to have a surgical procedure, end quote. That's a chilling thing in itself. Here she describes an abortion simply as a surgical procedure. A tonsillectomy is a surgical procedure. Open heart surgery is a surgical procedure. When it comes to abortion, referring to the termination of an unborn human life as merely a surgical procedure reveals a chilling understanding of the value of human life and the entire structure of morality. When it comes to another honoree on the list, Oprah Winfrey, many people in the media, including the liberal media, have been openly questioning why she received the award. As Roxanne Roberts and Emily Yar of the Washington Post Reliable Source column wrote, and Oprah? Harder to pin down exactly why she landed on the list, but that's the story of her career, end quote. Unlike nominees to federal judgeships and other selected federal positions, those the president nominates to receive the Medal of Freedom require no Senate confirmation. For that matter, no confirmation from anyone. The president gets to decide. And those who receive the award on Wednesday are those that reflect President Obama's decisions. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Baltimore, Maryland, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.